You're listening to The Good Morning Show with Oliver O.T. Thomas.
We're back. Welcome back to The Good Morning Show. Oliver O.T. Thomas, the early bird, entire WBOK listening audience, man. Definitely blessed to be with you guys, man. Love all y'all times 10. Hey, what do we do, right? What do we do with the 11-year-old? You know, at what point do we intervene so that 22 cars and break-ins and thefts are not, and burglaries are not 44? At what point do we intervene before the loss of life and property begins to mount, before more families are affected, before this individual, this life of this child, this adolescent, man, not even a teenager, is affected? And one of the defenders of the faith, right, and the law, we're fortunate enough to have one of our contributors, Ms. Alana Odoms Abe, Executive Director of the ACLU, Louisiana. Welcome back to the Good Morning Show.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
I know, first of all, I've seen you work before. I've seen you in forums and panels. We've been challenging our community, not just about the law, but about who we are, mm-hmm. As our people, our families, our businesses, our public policy. What do we do with that 11-year-old?
Yeah. So first and foremost,
when do we intervene?
I think it's very important for us to think about this child as a child. And I think what our criminal legal system fails to do is, in particular, to treat children as children, and more significantly, to treat Black children as children. The adultification of Black children, which is, our babies look and feel and should be treated more like adults than other people's children.
I said that earlier. I said that if you follow the train of how we've dealt with, especially young Black boys, right, at some point we'll miss it. He's 11 now. We'll miss it when he's 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. And at some point there'll be this image of him, and the system will celebrate because they got him.
Correct. And the fact is that this 11-year-old is still a baby. Mm-hmm. He's a baby. My daughter's 5 years old.
Dr. Sunita Singh just texted me on social media, basically talking about the mind and the brain and how different it is, and we really don't understand that or appreciate that yet.
We don't. You know, the United States Supreme Court does understand it, thankfully, as a result of the work of Brian Stevenson, a legal hero of mine, who formed the Equal Justice Initiative in 1989, yes. And the Just Mercy film is out. Mm-hmm. Recommend everybody in our listening community and beyond go see that movie. But yes, the Supreme Court says that children are different for purposes of sentencing. And the reason is because there are several reasons. Mm-hmm. Number one, their brains are not fully formed. The brain of a child doesn't actually fully form until 25 years old. It's unbelievable. So a lot of family members out here listening thinking, okay, this is why my child acted so crazy.
No, it's even deeper than that. So this is why this NFL, NBA basketball player, football player, soccer player, this is why they still acting a fool.
25 years old, not fully formed, probably a little longer for boys. Right. But the Supreme Court recognizes this. Right. And because your brain is not fully formed, you are not thought of as under the law as morally culpable as an adult. You are not able to, when your brain is not fully formed, you're not able to control your impulses. You are subject to significantly more peer pressure. Mm-hmm. And you are more likely to do things and not understand the consequences, even things that could be considered violent or very serious. You're not able to understand those consequences.
I want to say that because you made a real powerful point, man. I think you're on the adultification, especially of children of color, and specifically Black boys. When you look at mass incarceration, war on drugs versus an opioid epidemic or health crisis, how the system I had a judge apologize to me that a college student, young brother, who got in trouble for the first time, they had to give him 28 years because of the sentencing guidelines.
Yes.
Beautiful kid. I wish I didn't have to give him all that time. Well, you did. One of our agenda items is criminal justice reform.
Yes.
At what point, how do we attack this system? Because right now, right, we have criminal justice reform. It's in terms of how much money we save and what it's costing government, not about human capital and human lives.
And that's one of the most important things that the ACLU of Louisiana hopes to try to reframe the narrative and really shift the paradigm to understanding that there are entirely too many human costs, and the human costs outweigh the economic costs and any other costs that you might want to look at in terms of analyzing the system, because human beings, our children, our community members, they're our most precious resource. You cannot have a vibrant, economic, artistic, empowering community if you don't empower the people who make up that community. And so if you take a significant portion of your population and you throw them away, including children, you are significantly limiting what you can accomplish by way of medical advances, by way of business opportunity, economics, all those kinds of things, which is why human costs, we believe at the ACLU of Louisiana, are the most significant ones. And so while, and I'll say this, the Chief Justice always told me, she's an incredible mentor of mine. She said, listen, I believe deeply in the human cost. I believe in people.
Right.
But if I have to tell you, if I have to make this case to you and explain it to you in economics to help you understand, I'll do that. But we know what the central significant factor is, which is the lives that are derailed, especially those of our children. Mm-hmm. The last thing the Supreme Court says that is most important is that children have the greatest capacity for change.
Change.
That is why we treat children as children.
That was my question, is at what point do we get involved?
We have to get involved in it as early as we possibly can. Early childhood education.
Right.
We have to. Head Start programs. We have to. People, I'll shadow just this one point from the movie for you. When folks are on
Just Mercy.
Bryan Stevenson's film, Just Mercy, there's a key point in the film where someone on death row says, I woke up this morning and someone asked me what I wanted to eat. They asked me exactly what I wanted to eat. They asked me what I wanted to drink. They asked me if I wanted to go to the gym. They asked me if I wanted to go for a walk. They asked me all these different things. On the last day of my life, people cared more about me than every other day of my life. Why is it that we want to serve people on their last day and we don't want to serve babies on their first day?
Elena Odoms, first of all, thank you, man. I think we're answering a lot of questions right now. I think you're answering the question I put out there. It reminds me of the conversation that Attorney Tracy Washington and I had with Percy, young businessman Percy Marchand, and Cess 504, man, a local hip-hop artist and businessman. And I asked Cess about New Orleans and what the New Orleans mean to him growing up. And he was like, you know, it was always obvious as a young black man growing up that we didn't have enough resources for this. We didn't have enough for the right equipment at the park.
Yes.
We didn't have enough for after-school programs.
Yes.
We didn't have enough for skill trainings, and we didn't have enough for computer labs. He said, but every time we got in trouble, they had enough.
That's right. That's right.
That's what you're saying.
That is exactly what I'm saying. I am saying that the model that we built with justice reinvestment, which means you reduce incarceration, you stop the number of people going through the front door, and then what you do with those savings is you reinvest those savings into programs that help people, that programs that help children. We've got to do that. We've got to find the way in our budgets to prioritize serving children.
Elena Adams, what do you, Elena?
A budget is a moral document. Why can't we find money in our budgets in order to protect our children?
But what do we do with our frustrations, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, people want something to happen. I mean, you heard DJ, and we heard James earlier, who's like, man, I'm tired of losing my stuff. I'm tired of no one being accountable.
Listen, we've all had our cars broken into. I've had mine broken into 3, 4, 5 times. Seriously. I mean, look, everybody raise their hand. Everybody in New Orleans, everybody raise their hand. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't feel violated.
Right.
I'm not saying that we shouldn't feel a little bit unsafe. What I'm saying is our pain should not dictate our policy. Because if we allow our pain to dictate our policy,
it's the wrong policy.
It is the wrong policy. You know why? Because the policy is always going to be retributive.
Right.
The policy is always going to be an eye for an eye.
Right.
The policy is always going to be guided by anger, not love. Our laws and policies have to be centered on rehabilitation, in particular for children. That's what the juvenile justice system is about. The reason why we have two systems of justice, one called the juvenile justice system and one the criminal legal system, is because children are different.
Mm-hmm.
The entire model of the juvenile justice system is based on rehabilitation because of the many things that we just spoke about. Children are different. They're less morally culpable. They don't understand the consequences, and they have the greatest capacity for change. Rehabilitation. So if I a victim of a property crime or a theft get to determine and dictate that policy, I'm not going to be doing it based on the research. I may not even know the United States Supreme Court ruled in six different cases that children are different. I'm just going to say, I'm mad and I want my stuff back I want this person to pay. Pain cannot dictate policy.
I had someone told me a long time ago, man, I'm trying to remember to attribute who said, but they told me, they said, you know, the tougher we are on children, it means the tougher they'll be on us.
Wow.
And I'm seeing it play out right now because we're celebrating so much success around criminal justice reform, major crime going down. And in many cities, in many rural suburban communities across this country, I mean, right here in New Orleans, kids are going butt wild.
Yes.
We have not resourced our children.
We haven't. And you know, the other thing I think that is the elephant in the room is our obsession with guns and our obsession with this culture of violence, because we think our children don't see that. Mm-hmm. Most of these property crimes, these break-ins are happening is because children are trying to get guns,
looking for guns
in order to sell them. So we think every person should be a gun-toting, gun-carrying person in Louisiana. But then when our children go to try to get these guns to sell them, we say, oh, no. Absolutely not. We can't do that. So it's like we've got to model the kind of behavior that we want our children to demonstrate. We're not modeling that
behavior.
Elena
Odoms, when a mother says, I'm glad they have my 11-year-old, maybe he can get the help he needs now.
Let me explain. I'm not going to castigate that mother. What I'm going to say is that mother has also been the victim of a broken system who also failed her. Because that mother has had to struggle perhaps on her own without assistance, without the appropriate educational systems to provide for her children, without the appropriate economic opportunity for herself, perhaps not the appropriate mental health and health care conditions to help herself, will put you in the kind of condition which might tell you, hey, somebody come help me with my child any way possible. But she too, she is not to be condemned. She is to be someone who is looked at with eyes of compassion and respect, because when a system fails you, you say by any means necessary. And I can see from that statement that the system has failed her too.
We're going to take a break. You never know where your answers, man, and enlightenment will come from. Well, guess what? It just came from a moment with Elena Odoms Abag, Executive Director of the ACLU. But she's also got a pulse on our community and our lives. We'll be back with more after the break.
Take the Real Talk with you at all times by downloading the station app on any Apple or Android device. And follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at WBOK 1230 AM.
You're listening to The Good Morning Show with Oliver O.T. Thomas.
We're back. Welcome back to the Good Morning Show. Oliver O.T. Thomas, the early bird, entire WBOK listening audience, man. One of our contributors, man, Elena Odoms Abag, Executive Director of the ACLU of Louisiana. Well, first of all, thank you for contributing the way you do, whether it's at panels at universities, whether it's coming here, whether it's in court, whether it's fighting systems. You're talking about speaking truth to power, taking on the status quo. You've dedicated your life to this. I've heard you talk on a myriad of subjects, but I usually see you're composed, you know, you're an intellectual and an academic. I saw a level of passion from you in the first part of this interview about this situation that I rarely see. Explain that to me.
I get passionate about our kids. If we can't get excited about our children, I don't know what we can get excited about. I'm a mother. I'm a mom of a 5-year-old little girl. And that adultification process that happens to young boys, it also happens to young black girls. And
Especially today.
And it starts as early as kindergarten. They've done research that shows that teachers' eyes focus on the behaviors and the movements of mm-hmm. black children at 5 years old in kindergarten mm-hmm. more than they do on the behaviors right. and movements of white children right. such that
I'm watching you.
When a child acts up or when a child does what children do, mm-hmm. they're more likely to observe those as sequential offenses and to get more fed up
right.
with our children, because essentially it's a form of surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
And I just honestly think the work that we've done with our criminal legal system, and notice I'm saying criminal legal system as opposed to criminal justice right. system, because this is a system that doesn't give much justice mm-hmm. to anyone except people who can pay for it. We've not...
Roger Stone.
Exactly. Don't get me started. Don't even go. Ooh, that'd be a whole nother show, a whole nother OT show, which I'm happy to participate mm-hmm. in, because that's just some foolishness. We're really... This is a deep state situation here. This is just straight mafia. You just calling in favors. You got people who are made.
Elena Odom's unleashed.
Made. And if you made, then let's just... We just take care of it all. We wipe away crimes. We wipe away murder. We wipe away all this kind of stuff. This is a crazy situation that we are in this time in our history. It really is. And people feel empowered mm-hmm. to act in foolish ways because they know this is what they see at the highest levels of government. But when we deal... We're talking about our children... Mm-hmm. I think the most significant thing is that we've yet to do a wholesale revision of our juvenile justice system the way that we've done with our criminal legal system. And it is
obvious.
Overdue.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that we did that was the most significant thing about the criminal justice reform package of 2017 is we said there are a whole host of crimes that, you know what, essentially they shouldn't even be eligible for jail time. And I think that's the exact same mm-hmm. thing that we need to do with our juvenile justice system, because if we leave prison or jail or secure care, when it's called for children, secure care is what they're calling it, care.
Right.
If we leave that up to legislators or frankly even judges, and I'm not trying to speak harshly about our judges, but what I'm saying is that when you are a hammer, mm-hmm. everything looks like a nail. So if we leave these problems of behavior and necessary counseling and things to our juvenile justice system for judges to handle, they're likely to use the tools within their resources, which is to put children in care, secure care or custody. We've got to use different systems to solve these problems. We need cognitive behavioral therapy for our children. We need mental health care for our children. We need restorative justice for our children. Right. You've got to model the kind of behavior that you want to see children exhibit. Restorative justice means when you've taken something, you've got to look the person who you've stolen right. from in the eye.
And it works.
You've got to hear from them mm-hmm. how you've impacted their life. You've got to go out and get a job or sell cookies or Girl Scouts or do whatever you got to do in order to start to pay restitution. It might not be dollar for dollar, but you've got to do something right. to rectify the harm that you've caused. None of those things happen in jail. You're not looking face to face with the person you've harmed. You're not seeing their pain. You're not hearing. No. You're not hearing from the young man or young woman whose car you've broken into that now they can't pay their rent because now they've got to try and pay for their broken car. Now they can't get to their job. Now they've lost their job. Children understand those concepts. They've got to be able to hear them from the victims who they've caused harm to. That doesn't happen in jail. That happens through restorative justice and restorative justice only.
I want to say that we're going to get to the gala and the event, but this is an important discussion, especially with someone who's dedicated their life to justice, but also to our culture and our community. Whenever I talk to kids, I don't know why that I'm surprised, but especially over the last several years, they're keenly aware of their social standing.
Oh, yes.
In their position.
Yes, they are.
From religion to politics to what happens in and outside of the homes. One of the kids that I met about 10 kids, some of the kids who are out there in the street. You know, Wendell Pierce and I are looking at adopting or dealing with a group of kids. We know who are the kids that are targeted, right, and who have targeted us.
Yes.
So I sat down with Brother Hakim and one of the kids, and when we started the conversation, you know, as soon as we got into it, he looked at me and he looked at us and he said, I bet y'all had parents. Oh. Right? And then there was another panel of kids that we had here, and we were talking about kids and society. And so I asked the kid, I said, well, what's the one of the most obvious things about your opposition is that what? She said, well, nobody asked us anything.
Wow.
People talk to us. Wow. They don't have conversations with us.
Wow.
These kids, no matter how functional or dysfunctional we think they are, they're more keenly aware of their social standing and position than we give them credit for.
Yes, 100%. I like to remind folks, because this is Black History Month, so we should talk a little bit about Black history.
Absolutely.
Most of the people who catalyzed the Black history, catalyzed the Civil Rights Movement were children. These were people 16 years of age and younger. Mm-hmm. Who were involved in completely reorienting United States politics.
Hundreds of thousands of kids across this country in the marches.
Hundreds of children. Because they do know. Because they do understand injustice. Mm-hmm. Because injustice is just as plain to see and feel. My daughter could tell you at 5 years old right now something that is fair or something that's unfair. Right. And they know what's happening to them. And it is a disgrace, because there are so many principles that we hold on to so deeply. We talk about the founding fathers. We talk about the Constitution of the United States and of the state of Louisiana. And we talk about the laws, ordinances of the city. And it is outrageous to our children that adults can walk around and cite these things and talk about these things and walk past them on the street in Royal Street with their playing their buckets and not help them. That is a shame.
Ms. Odom Zebair, we had a roundtable discussion with a few of our top criminal justice and criminal attorneys, Ike Spears, Nandi Campbell, and Clarence Roby.
I love all those people. Those are wonderful people.
And they were talking about the next step, what really doesn't happen from when you talk about real reform. From what you're saying, the criminal justice reform is one thing, but dealing with that individual is a whole other thing. Mm-hmm. And I often remind Clarence Roby of something he told me several years ago when I asked him, because of my own personal life and things I was going through, I asked him about justice. And I said, how do we get to a just society? And I never forgot. He stopped and he paused a minute. He looked at me and he says, there will never be real justice until the judge is just, the prosecutor is just, the defense attorney is just, and the system is just. Mm-hmm. He says, if you're a person of faith, how can you ever have justice just for the people? If the people who mete out justice aren't just, there'll never be real justice.
That's exactly right. And I think that's one of the reasons why our commitment to defending the Bill of Rights and the Constitution,
that's what you do,
comes with, but importantly, and this is something that I'm happy to tell your listening audience that I've been really praying and reflecting on. What does it mean to defend the Bill of Rights and the Constitution?
For everybody.
For everybody. What does it mean in particular, though, to defend the Bill of Rights and the Constitution for those who have historically been disfavored, those who've been condemned, mm-hmm. those who've been incarcerated, those who've been cast aside? Our belief, and my belief, is that we always have to do this work, this legacy work of history, by looking specifically at racial injustice. We've got to refract the Bill of Rights and the Constitution through the lens of mm-hmm. racial justice. That is what we've got to, because it's the beginning of the founding of this country, and it is deeply atomized into our democracy.
We can't get around it.
We can't get around it.
Not if we want real justice.
No, so just saying Bill of Rights or just saying Constitution is not enough. It is not enough.
Ms. Odom Zebair, the executive director of the ACLU, the case against Leon Cannizzaro, man, we've seen we get a lot of attention. I think he's asked for it to be dismissed or thrown out.
Talking about justice, that's right.
It's fake subpoenas.
Yeah, so, nobody's above the law. Nobody's above the law. And frankly, when people say that, I think people kind of snicker as well, and I think children snicker too, because frankly, there have been people who've been above the law who can just say, you know what? I am the power. I'm the state. I can do with that power whatever I wish. I can bring the charges. I can trump them up. I can trump them up. Pun intended. I can dismiss them for the people that I want to. If you're my people, I can dismiss them. Right. And I can also coerce. I can use the power of the state to coerce you to show up. And the ACLU of Louisiana said, you know what? No one should be above justice, even if you are the prosecutor. As a matter of fact, especially if you are the prosecutor, you don't get to misuse and take our criminal statutes and use them to your own benefit.
Well, we have an education lesson here, man. I'm reminded of so much. We got to go to break, but Mamiya Abu-Jamal's book, Jailhouse Lawyer, How Forced Pleas Right Now Are Destroying the Criminal Justice System. Elena Adams, Alana.
Alana.
Yep. Alana Odoms Hebert, man. What a treat always to talk to. When we come back, want to talk about immigrants' rights, man. And then, of course, the annual gala, man. The Ben Smith feat. Ben Smith feat?
Fete.
The Ben Smith.
It's French. It's fete. Fete.
The Ben Smith fete, April 2nd gala. We'll be back after the break.
Connecting our community for over 70 years.
Over 70 years.
WBOK, 1230 a.m.
You're listening to The Good Morning Show with Oliver O.T. Thomas.
We are back in the studio, Miss Odoms Hebert, man, and one of our leading intellectuals in the studio. You're talking about the law, right? I want to get back to the point that you made. I mean, well, first of all, thank you not just for being prepared to talk about the agenda, the stuff that you guys are working on, but being prepared to talk about, I think, what real life, what real justice is, and
yes,
how we ought to look at it from a human position. You brought to my mind when you talk about how the systems operate. So Mumia Abu-Jamal, his book, Jailhouse Lawyer, he talks about how forced pleas and forced prosecution are actually basically killing any semblance of criminal justice.
Right.
It's destroying that.
Yes.
And that when you read his book, he's saying that if we continue to walk down that path, we're more akin to concentration camps and Soviet tribunals.
Yes.
And anything but justice.
Yes. 95% of cases are resolved via a plea agreement. 95%. And things like the habitual offender law, which allows a prosecutor at their whim mm-hmm. to enhance your penalty based upon an offense that you committed in the past,
right.
which you also served time for. An offense committed in the past, which you also served time for, allows them to enhance your sentence. Or even if they choose not to use the habitual offender statute, they can threaten you with it and tell you that if you go to trial, they will then use the habitual offender statute. So these are all ways to coerce people to plea. And so the thesis of this book,
right.
though I have not read it, which I right. hopefully
right.
I will be able to read it,
absolutely.
Is that your right to be able to seek a trial, which is among your constitutional rights. Again, going back to what the Constitution says versus
great
what
point.
Reality is. That doesn't happen. And I'll say this.
Great
I want
point.
The readers to understand
right.
and know we're doing a really important study. We've studied this for 2 years, and our findings mm-hmm. are about to come out on pretrial incarceration. We have a big problem with pretrial incarceration mm-hmm. in Louisiana. We have a problem, period. We're obsessed with all types of incarceration, pretrial, regular, everything. But we looked for 2 years, and we studied over 50 parishes in Louisiana, and we asked each individual sheriff, who's in your jail? For how long and why?
Why?
And those results are going to be coming out in the next like 2 weeks or so. A 2-year study looking at.
Definitely got to do a show on
we
it right
got,
here.
Oh my gosh, I would love to
absolutely.
Be. I'd love to come back and show you. But what it's going to tell us is what we already know and a little bit more. We know who's in jail. It's us.
It's us.
That's why they say justice is just us. And we know this. But pretrial incarceration is even more problematic. The reason it's more problematic is because you are sitting in jail, you've yet to be charged, and you've yet to receive your trial.
Immigration and deportation, of course, immigration right now with the wall.
Yes.
And all this other
yes.
stuff.
Yes,
that
Mexico was going to pay for, right? That they were going to pay for, that we're paying for.
It's kind of center stage. But it also reminds me, and I think you guys are dealing with Manuel Amaya Portillo, his
yes.
case, but it reminds me of a little time that, you know, when I was on vacation. I'll never forget Jesse, man. A Latin brother, man, who was doing time
yes.
with us. And he was there because he was waiting on immigration court,
yes.
right? And so I was talking to him, and I was like, but Jesse, man, he said, well, when you go on to court? He said, well, I don't know. He said, they have up to 2 years to hold me, right, without even taking me to court. And he said, they don't have nothing on me. He said, but they can sit. And
just
I can
lock you up indefinitely
mm-hmm. for 2 years until then they have to guarantee me a date, and then they let him go.
Right. So they had just held him. So that's the thing about pretrial incarceration, and we'll talk about definitely mention and discuss the immigration situation. But the thing that we're seeing is that you can be held for 45 or 60 days before the district attorney has to charge you. But then the charges can be dropped, and you could have already been in jail for a month and a half, 2 months, 3 months. And or you could have bonded out, you pay the money,
right.
and they drop the charges. After that.
Right.
Your life already ruined. You're in financial despair. And the situation with immigration is very dire. We have 10,000 people in detention centers in Louisiana.
They've created immigration centers attached to federal prisons in this country.
Immigration centers. And you know why? Because it's profitable. Louisiana.
Hold on a second.
Now,
we haven't heard that part of it.
It is profitable. This is the most profitable thing that can happen in this state, unfortunately. The beds that were vacated by the criminal justice reform package that was passed in 2017 are now being filled with our immigrant asylum-seeking community members because it pays. It pays. It's a windfall for sheriffs and for parishes around this state to have federal contracts with ICE because they pay $70 per detainee. The state of Louisiana... The state of Louisiana pays $24.39. What deal you want to take? You want the $70 or you want the $24.39?
You want the 70.
I want 70. That's right. Three times as much. And I'll tell you this. It costs $125 per person or $150 per person to house somebody in Texas or California, the second and third most populous state for housing folks who are detained for their immigration cases. It's cheaper to put them here, which is why the detention centers are popping up all over the place.
It's about the money?
All about the money. All and only.
Unleashed and unlocked right here in WBOK, Ms. Odoms Hebert. Mr. Portillo,
so we went and visited three detention centers just right before Thanksgiving, and were able to see Mr. Portillo, who is a young man, a very young man, with a host of very significant disabilities. This young man needed a wheelchair. He was not provided a wheelchair. He was not provided any kind of access to care. And as a matter of fact, he was sedated when the federal government came in to do the checks that they're supposed to do to make sure that there are humane and constitutional conditions. They drugged him and put him in a corner so that he couldn't speak up and explain that he wasn't being cared for appropriately. We were outraged, and there are many people who are fighting on the ground to do this. Homero Lopez and Isla and Project Ishmael and other organizations are dedicated specifically to this task of trying to represent the 10,000 people who are detained, as Mr. Portillo was. We only represented one, but this one man deserved. He was an asylum seeker. Let it be clear to this community right now.
And in a wheelchair.
In a wheelchair with a very severe disability that doesn't even allow him to walk. He is an asylum seeker. It is not a crime to seek asylum in this country. It only became a crime under this particular administration. That is a policy. There is something called humanitarian parole, which is what we were able to secure for Mr. Portillo, which means that you, while you are waiting for your immigration case to proceed, you don't have to be locked up. Wow. Why should you be locked up?
You know we got to do more than an hour or 45 minutes next time we have this great woman on the show. But man, so much is coming to light right now. I'm looking at EPA officials are defending the DANCA plant right now. We're talking about relaxing regulations on our environment. Right, abusing the whole immigration court system.
That's a money grab, y'all. We gotta listen. They're telling you it's about your safety. They're telling you these people want your jobs. They're telling you the president said the people are racist. Rapists and criminals. No, this is about money.
I'm going to ask you this question right now. We only got a couple minutes, and it's becoming clearer and clearer to me, and as we talk to folk like you and watch the fight out there. Are we in a period in history right now where the fight for justice and fairness is as great as it's ever been?
Absolutely. The fight for justice.
You didn't stutter.
Absolutely. Yeah, I don't have any hesitation about saying that whatsoever. History, I like to think of it as a pendulum and the way that the pendulum swings forward and it swings back. We are in a time of this pendulum swinging almost as far back as it ever has.
Going to determine our future and our humanity?
Oh, 100%.
Right now, today?
And so we better decide which side of this we want to be on. You have to make a decision right now whether you're going to be on the right side of history.
Alana Odoms, that's almost biblical and spiritual the way you're explaining that now.
It's the truth. Because no one's going to tell you. Do you think people during the Civil Rights Movement, somebody was telling them, hey, you know, this is going to be history. What you do today is going to determine history. No. History is something that people usually look back on and say that was history. So it's incumbent upon us to decide right now and to recognize that this is history.
And you don't want to have to say I told you so.
I would never say that. That's not a, that would never come out of my mouth because that's an egocentric statement. What I think it would, what we would and should be saying as a community is, where do we want to be?
Well, let's come on. We got a minute left this event, man. The Ben Smith FET April 2nd event. How can people participate?
I want everybody.
You got a spot for me?
A VIP spot right up in the front.
I'm going to be there.
I want you to be there. Our tickets are on sale. Go to laaclu.org. We have some opportunities for folks who, even if you can't necessarily pay the full price for the ticket, we want you in the building. We want this to be the most inclusive, the most diverse, the most robust, the most powerful ACLU gala that we've ever
had. And where do I have to go to get the tickets?
You go to laaclu.org, and we have a link there to get the tickets.
I'm going
to
be there, man.
I hope you are.
Well, first of all... I appreciate what you do as the leader of the ACLU and defender of our rights and defining what justice is. I appreciate what you do in challenging us, man, in terms of the law and how it applies. But the thing I appreciate most of you is challenging us about where is our humanity? Where was it? Where is it? And where will it be? We thank you for that.
Thank you. We can always find it.
Hey, man, this is the end of this show today, man. We're going to play back Jimmy Gardner, man, the young man who was wrongfully incarcerated. This is a great match for what we talked about here with this great leader of justice in our community. Everybody have a wonderful day. And remember, there are a lot of hurdles and obstacles in front of you. Many of them are not your fault, right? But if you're looking in the mirror and you're the only person you see, don't wait for somebody else to move them out of the way. Start working on it yourself. And let's not forget about the NOLA 360 Education Forum tonight. That's at the Greater New Orleans Foundation, 919 St. Charles Avenue. The topic is going to be what our students need and how can we help them. That's at 6:15 today, 919 St. Charles. Be there. Now, you won't be square, but just be there.